On this episode of Pilot's Discretion, our guest is light sport aircraft expert Dan Johnson. He tells us what the FAA's recent Mosaic proposal means, how it might impact the LSA industry, and his favorite kit airplane. Pilot's Discretion starts right now. Welcome, pilots. I'm John Zimmerman, and thanks for listening. If you like Pilot's Discretion, please leave a review for us in your favorite podcast app. And remember, you can catch up on every previous episode by visiting sporties.com/podcast. You can also email us with comments and guest ideas at podcast@sporties.com. Today, I'm excited to have Dan Johnson with us. He probably knows more about light aircraft than anyone alive today, having written hundreds of pilot reports on light sport aircraft, ultralights, and kit-built airplanes, first for his website, bydanjohnson.com, and now as a part of the Flying Media Group. He is also a 6,000-hour commercial pilot and president of the Light Aircraft Manufacturers Association. He is absolutely the first person I read when I want to know about LSAs or sport pilot topics. Dan, welcome to Pilot's Discretion.
Well, thank you, John, for that very kind introduction. It's, I think, got to be a little bit over the top, but I sure do appreciate it. And it is great to play in my favorite little sandbox.
Well, we'll put you to the test early here because the big news this summer has been all about the FAA's Mosaic proposal, or Modernization of Special Airworthiness Certificates. It's over 300 pages, but it promises to change how light aircraft are designed and approved. I have many, many questions about this, but let's start with a nutshell summary of what's actually being proposed here.
Well, all along, FAA has perceived that there was a gap between the high end of light sport aircraft, which was limited by a specific weight they gave, 1,320 pounds or 600 kilograms for land airplanes and a little bit more for seaplanes. And then between that point and what they perceived to be the low end of the general aviation or legacy market, if you want to call it those terms, that started in the high 20s, maybe 3,000 pounds, and went from there. And they saw a gap in between. And they also perceived that while these airplanes were enjoying a good introduction into the flight school market, they weren't necessarily doing the job quite as well as they might have if they were allowed just a little more weight. And the whole thing kind of surrounded weight for a long time. But then it began to evolve. And along the way, other people got involved and made other requests. And that has led us to a position now where the almost 20-year-old sport pilot light sport aircraft rule is evolving into the new Mosaic rule, but not leaving the old part abandoned. It continues on. We add to it. So it's an expansion as well as a modernization of the special aircraft certificate aircraft.
And it's worth pointing out there were some earlier proposals, or at least leaked ideas of proposals out there about kind of complicated performance formulas and how would we draw the line. And the new proposal is fairly straightforward in terms of mostly about stall speed. Is that correct?
It's a beautiful thing, I think, actually, because not only was the other thing complicated and difficult for both FAA to create so that it would achieve what they wanted to do with that, it was not a new thing. They re-erected something that had been there before, so it wasn't all clean sheet design ideas, but it was complicated. And then it was complicated for the manufacturer to understand properly what FAA was asking for, and then for the user to go, okay, so how does this affect me? That was just a difficult situation, and honestly, it was getting a lot of negative response. To their credit, they went, look, that's not going to work. Not only that, because they can't enforce such a thing. How do you stay on top of that, even if it is a good idea? So back and forth with various ideas, wing loading among them and other criteria that might work. What we have at the end is not really a weight limit. It's often said these are about 3,000-pound airplanes or could be up to about 3,000-pound airplanes. Actually, that's not the limitation. The limitation is very simple and easy. It's 54 knots clean stall. Everybody gets that number. It's not in the landing configuration. It's in the flying configuration. If the stall is 54 knots or less, good to go as a Mosaic LSA.
And that draws the boundaries fairly broadly, if I'm correct. I mean, that's going to include Cessna 172s. That's going to include even some earlier Cessna 182s, potentially some PA-28s, although there's some potential limitations there, but it's worth pointing out this is not a minor bump up that's going to add a couple of more vintage airplanes. This is a quite significant expansion of what would be included. Is that right?
Yes, it went up quite a bit. And so the new aircrafts that will evolve to meet this specifically, and there's already a whole batch of them that are on the way because the industry has known about where this was going to some extent. We can come back to that if you like through the ASTM process. But the fact of the matter is, yes, it does throw the door wide open to those so-called GA or legacy airplanes like the 172, the 182, and all the numbers you just mentioned are right on the money, 170s. There's a whole bunch of airplanes that could be in there. Now, they won't lose or give up their standard certificate that they already have. They won't become special certificated aircraft in any way, but they can be what makes this important is it now shifts over to the pilot side and what you can do with what certificate, meaning do you need a medical or not, and then what you can do if you meet various criteria. That seems to be where a lot of the focus is. And John, I think the reason for some of that is because we've had ideas all along about how the aircraft themselves might have to look in order to meet what FAA had in mind. And the reason why we would know that and less about the pilot side is because of the use of industry consensus standards, which is a new thing 20 years ago when it was introduced. It's almost 20 years now we've had LSA, and that has been basically the test vehicle for this concept where industry creates the standards on how an aircraft should, what an aircraft should meet in order to be a safe, reliable, easy to operate aircraft. And the beauty of that is those things can be changed rapidly when there's a problem or when there's a new need. So there's a lot of versatility there, but of course, all the burden sitting on the shoulders of the manufacturers. Same people who got to build the airplanes have also got to help write the standards that their airplanes are going to meet, which I know sounds like, well, wouldn't they just make it easy on themselves? Well, no, because they're making it easy on their competitors too then. So that doesn't help them. In fact, they want it to be fairly tough, and these standards are fairly tough, but it's a whole new thing. And it throws people for a kind of a loop. So there's a lot of study going on about this at this time.
That's an important point I think you raised there. There's a difference between light sport aircraft, which has to do with certifying or approving airplanes, and the sport pilot, which has to do with the people that fly those airplanes. They're often conflated, but there's important differences there. And so let's take that in the context of this new Mosaic rule. You could absolutely have a scenario, which you mentioned, where you have a Cessna 172, maybe 50 years old, certified as a standard, you know, Part 23 airplane. And so that part's not changing. That's not going to become an LSA, as you said, but it does open that up to a sport pilot. So give me some specifics of how that matters. There's issues of the maintenance of an airplane and what's allowed in an LSA versus a standard category. But then there's also, what can you fly? And I know one topic, for example, that's come up is flying at night for sport pilots and how this has to do with the new Mosaic rules. Can you walk us through that minefield of pilot versus airplane?
Yeah, let's do a little definitional thing up front, because a lot of people it's an innocent error. Nobody's trying to be ill-informed about it or anything, but people often say, well, I'm either a light sport pilot, or you have to be a light sport in order to fly that airplane, or some reference like that. And that's not really what they mean. They mean to operate an aircraft that looks like a light sport, but what they're really talking about is the sport pilot certificate. And so when I say there is no such thing as a light sport certificate, there is a sport pilot certificate or a private certificate, and there's a light sport airworthiness certificate, and those are different things. And FAA likes that word certificate, so it's easy why people might get confused. But first, you have to separate those two. So yes, there is the aircraft and what it can be, which is these LSA, old or new ones, and the legacy aircraft that might fit, and then there's the sport pilot certificate, which gets special attention because it still retains something very precious in the aviation spectrum, and that is the lack of a need for any aviation medical. A driver's license, which does require some medical requirements to it. You can't be blind, for example, and get a driver's license. So there are requirements within it. Are they as sturdy as the ones required for a third class medical? Well, that's something other people with more knowledge than me can debate, but the fact is, it's one of the special parts about it, because if people have suffered a medical problem and are healed from that now, but FAA looks at it unkindly, they may not be able to fly. And that's a shame, I think, especially because the accident statistics surrounding medically related problems are just vanishingly small. No one really disputes that, and yet there is this real clinging on to the aviation medical as a thing that's going to improve aviation safety, which I think is hard to actually defend, but it's embedded deeply, and it's hard to get that out. And, you know, we have good ideas and we stick to those ideas. Sometimes we need to give those ideas up, but it's hard because we thought they were great ideas at one time. You know, we're just humans. That's our process. Nonetheless, this has made a special thing now. So this focus is intense on whether you need a medical or not to do various things, like carry more passengers than one, like fly at night, like fly IFR. Those things all are attached to the medical. But within the document, John, it's not exactly clear. People at FAA, people whose names I know and attached to the right aviation departments, have said unequivocally, it's been reported to me, that a medical, either basic med or conventional third class or better, is required for a sport pilot certificate holder to fly at night. And if you had that, then, well, you're probably going to go up to private anyway because you have a medical, basically. But throughout the document, it talks about a sport pilot getting endorsements to fly at night. Well, a sport pilot wouldn't need an endorsement to fly at night if he had a medical, because then he qualifies under the private rules if he had that particular certificate. So there's some conflict within the document still to be resolved. And you know what? That's not putting fault on FAA. That's the whole process here. They do their best job. It's a pretty good document. But I even found a couple of typos in it, and there are things that they can tune up and get better, and they know that, and they invite that. So this is an ongoing process, but that clock is ticking. We're already we're within the 90-day window here. So a bunch of people are moving quickly, I hope, to try and bring out the bullet points and show what the things are, like we're doing here, to educate people about this. And then please go read this darn thing and pick out the parts that affect you or that are meaningful to you and comment on them. FAA will receive those and they have to look at every one. So I hope it's incumbent upon everybody for whom this effect has some effect to go do that.
Let's talk about that process a little bit more, because it is a notice of proposed rulemaking. As you mentioned, the FAA is accepting comments, and as you have done on your website many times, encouraging folks to do that. But what happens after that? After comments are received, what's the process, and when might this realistically become the law of the land and we can all start taking advantage of some of it?
Sure. A word of caution about comments. It's always been said, don't just copy what your buddy wrote. We've known that in the political type process for a long time. But now that now FAA has technology. So if two letters come in that are, word for word identical, it's going to count as one letter because it is one letter. It's just another person sent it. So you need to add your own language into it. Best if you use somebody else's words, but add your own words into it. Make it yours. Then they have to read every single one. They have to do something with every single one of those. Think about that. There could be tens of thousands of these, maybe. That's a lot of work. So how long is that going to take? FAA has said all along that this process from issue date of the NPRM, which happened on July 24th, just a week and change ago, that it would be 16 months. Well, if that's so, that translates to right at the end of 2024, and give a little bit of bureaucratic time and the Christmas holiday that'll be just happening right about then. I would say basically January 2025 is when this thing will hit. And I don't see any reason why it shouldn't, because I think they're pretty darn close to the mark now with what everyone expected. In fact, we got more than we expected in a number of ways. But everything we did ask for, even including one that I thought would be one of the most difficult, which is the potential to use LSA for aerial work. We got quite a bit of pushback from FAA at first. LAMA, that was one thing that LAMA in particular went for on behalf of our members. And we provided a white paper to them and really walked them through the safety argument for it. And they were quite receptive. And here it is, made it into the rule. So things like that are important. But people just need, this thing is so sweeping in so many ways that an individual can't really, you could try and comment on the whole thing, but good heavens, that's a lot of work. I would say focus on the things that are meaningful to you. which means you got to scan the whole thing. It's not easy, and people will help. Other people will help bring to attention. But we can go over some of the highlights that are in it, and you can go, well, that's really important to me. Fine. In the age we have now, you can have this on your device. You can have the whole thing on your iPad or your iPhone or, you know, any of your devices, Android or whatever. And you can use search, and you can go search for the particular thing you want. And you can it's much easier than it used to be back in the, quote, old days.
So let's fast forward to 2025. Let's assume this makes it through with no major changes to it, maybe a couple of minor revisions. What does that world look like in 2025, 2026? And let's talk particularly about the new airplane side. We mentioned how existing airplanes, Cessna 172s, now would be covered by this. But what are your hopes for the light aircraft industry in terms of new designs coming out to fill that gap between the 1,300-pound and under traditional LSAs and the legacy certified airplanes? What would you hope airplane manufacturers and inventors are going to be doing with this new regime?
That's the new and exciting part for sure, John. But let me first state that all those 1,320-pound airplanes of today all still will do everything they do today just fine. Those airplanes have already had most of their design costs amortized, and they've had enough opportunity to make a number of these things that they have service networks and other things all set up and spares on place. So the airplanes that exist now, no loss in utility or value to the owner whatsoever, in my opinion. What we're doing here is adding, but boy, are we adding. So let's go somewhere up past 3,000 pounds is what I would guess. A 182 is slightly over that line. If it can make the 54 knot clean number, then good to go. Some, as you mentioned early on, do make that. Some of the later ones don't. Only by a knot or two in some cases, like some of the PA-28s as well, Pipers, that is. But and maybe comments will move that number up a bit, but my guess is 54 knots is a pretty hard line in the sand. It's already pretty generous, I think. I don't see it going higher. And what we're talking about there is VS1 to some people, not VS0. Okay, the other one that was a big gimme that I think nobody expected was speed up to 250 knots. Now that's the speed limit below 10,000 feet. So I think FAA amongst themselves went, well, you know, a lot of what we've seen is these guys have learned to play by the rules. Why shouldn't they get that privilege? So we're seeing speeds up to that, which also implies, of course, things like retractable gear and in-flight adjustable props. And I say it that way rather than constant speed, because they may not be configured the way we're used to in the GA market today. They could be single lever like Cirrus uses and has made extremely popular. That's one option. That's what Lama actually asked for. But they can also be some other kinds of adjustable props. But my guess is the most popular ones will be various kinds of automatic adjustments. Put it in climb, put it in cruise, whatever, like that. And the computers on today's modern engines can really help do all that. So we'll see that. But we'll also see four-place aircraft. Now, a sport pilot, again, we're back to that. We're back to the license side again, but a sport pilot will be able to fly a four-place aircraft, just not with four people, with not four total occupants, one passenger and him or herself, and that's all that can be on board for a sport pilot at this time. Night flight, kind of the same thing. It's going to be permitted, but not really for a sport pilot, so that's now we're back to, well, then why is it in this rule? So that the aircraft can be equipped for it? Well, they can already be equipped for it, so I'm not sure, quite sure how FAA needs to resolve that, but that's one that will be one of those contested points, perhaps. Clean stall, we've mentioned already, 54 knots. Helicopters, we didn't even ask for that. We didn't think that was possible. We did get fully built gyros, and that was something we lobbied long and hard for and put safety information together for FAA. And that was one of the biggest battles due to the old, now defunct, rotorcraft directorate, who just didn't like those things, I guess. Anyway, they didn't get through for 20 years, but now they're finally going through. But then they just said, well, how about helicopters too? Okay. They have to be easy to fly, maintain, and operate, FAA's mantra. And when FAA issued that mantra, they told industry, we don't know how to define easy. You do it. So the ASTM committee defined easy for those things, and FAA went, yep, that's pretty much what we had in mind. So that's how that relationship works, but it produced that. It also produced turbine engines, which is especially ironic because the SPLSA rule forbade electric. Now, electric wasn't much to talk about 20 years ago, of course, and FAA really wasn't after electric at all. They didn't care about electric. They hardly knew about electric. What they didn't want was turbines, so they said reciprocating only, which knocked out electric. So we haven't had electric LSA all this time for that reason. Now, not only did they say, okay, you can have electric, but you can have turbine too. And so not only do we have electric, but we have hybrid. We didn't ask for that either. This is just a whole bunch more stuff than we even asked for, but you know, Christmas in July is not such a bad thing, I think.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. The idea that we could have in a couple of years a single engine turboprop with four seats and retractable gear, and that would be under this Mosaic rule is definitely more than I ever hoped for. So, you know, definitely some footnotes we'll have to watch and everything, but anybody who's been watching the FAA for a long time would have to admit that we got probably more than we could have hoped for. So while this all sounds like great news, I got to ask you, what's the bad news in Mosaic? Is there something in there that you think was a miss or that you really hope gets fixed in comments?
I would say the main thing we've already touched on is this business about exactly what do you intend that a sport pilot can get endorsed to do it. We didn't really go too much into endorsements, but most pilots know what an endorsement is. You fly with an instructor, you do something, you show that you have satisfactory acquisition of the skill. Your instructor writes something in your book, an endorsement in your book, and you're good to go if that's what it is. LSA has made, and sport pilot has made great use of that because they've allowed endorsements for all kinds of things. And that's the idea that's expressed throughout this document. And yet they say, but a sport pilot has got to have a medical. Well, a sport pilot doesn't have to have a medical, and that conflict has got to get resolved, and that'll trigger into several other things. Also, this rule we haven't touched on, my focus is on the LSA and that segment. This also touches kits, this touches warbirds. This is a fairly sweeping rule in a variety of ways, which makes it all the more important that they've opened the door and said, industry, we want you to do more.
And what will we call these airplanes? Are these still LSAs? Are they Mosaic LSAs? Are they just light aircraft? What do you suspect pilots will call these airplanes that qualify to distinguish them from what we had before?
Well, as a writer guy, I've grappled with that problem already. So for myself anyway, I don't know if people will adopt it or not, who knows, but I've called them Mosaic LSA or just MLSA, which I'm kind of triggering off of the mRNA from the COVID era that people now know that type of spelling where it's a small M and a capital LSA. To me, that works and it's quick and short and kind of expresses that this is something more, M, more than an LSA, and yet not a GA or whatever else you want to call those aircraft. So that kind of fits for me. We'll see if my push to call it that sticks.
I like it. We'll beat the drum for that one, Dan. Thanks for that. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, let's talk some more about LSAs and home builds in general.
A portable radio can be a lifesaver during an emergency, but there's no time for instruction manuals or complicated adapter cables. That's why the pilots at Sporty's designed the PJ2 Plus and L6 comm radios, the only radios with built-in aviation headset jacks. These simple and reliable radios let you plug right in and stay focused on flying. The PJ2 Plus features twin PJ jacks, while the L6 has a 6-pin LiMo plug for panel-powered headsets. Both are available for under $300. Visit sporties.com/radios to order. Now, back to pilot's discretion.
We're back with Dan Johnson, who tracks the LSA and kit industry closer than anyone. He's got some great data on his website, which you can find. And Dan, let's talk about LSAs in the pre-Mosaic sense. 20 years ago, there was some hope in the industry that we'd have this new class of airplanes and they'd sell for under $100,000. Some people have expressed some regret that didn't really happen. Why do you think that didn't happen? Or did it happen and we just didn't notice it?
Well, first of all, there are aircraft today for under $100,000. There are several aircraft. Now, is it the one you want? Is it the carbon fiber speedster with the, you know, with all the bells and whistles on it? No, not for that price, it won't be. But also, you have to factor in time value of money. You know, 20 years ago, I mean, everybody knows we're grappling with a lot of inflation now that we didn't have a while back. And, you know, how much does that affect all of this? So this rule came out in 2004 when, and people's expectations actually go back to, I don't know, let's say 2002 or whatever, because you might recall we waited on this rule for about 3 years, actually, it was before it came out. Which I'm fairly convinced, based on a lot of conversations I've had, that it was FAA legal that was just uncomfortable with the medical side, the doing away with the medical for the first time is what happened 20 years ago. And FAA legal was real uncomfortable with that and fought against it for a long time until it just got the force of personality or whatever to push it through. So, that being the case, if you go back to 2002 and if you thought $100,000, well, you know, that's close to $200,000, $170,000 or so today. So if an airplane is $170,000, you go, wow, that's just too expensive. I thought they were only going to be $100,000. Well, they are $100,000 if you want to think of it that way. What you thought then and what it is now, that is really only a $100,000 airplane. But there are airplanes for less than that, a good bit less than that. It depends on what you're going to accept. There are some very creative airplanes out in the marketplace for in the $70,000 to $90,000 range. And there are ones that are less than that, too. You can get a ready-to-fly brand-new special LSA for as low as $30,000. But it may be a powered parachute, or it may be a gyroplane, or something like that that you didn't really calculate into your original consideration. So, but there are also some fixed wings. They're just not going to be carbon fiber speedsters with all the bells and whistles on them. Those airplanes, you have to expect. When we first started with these airplanes, they were fairly simple. Nobody thought about autopilot. As a matter of fact, I thought an autopilot on these airplanes was an abomination. You're supposed to enjoy moving the stick around and getting your skills built and whipping around to look at that alligator you see down there on the ground or whatever. It's what we do down here in Florida, I guess. But now, you know, I'm just like everybody else. I take off the runway, I'm engaging the autopilot because all these things have autopilot on them now. Well, that comes with a cost. It's beautiful. It's great for cross-country flying. It's probably safer, just like the screens that tell us where all the targets are out there that we can't see with our old eyes yet. That's a great thing, too, but it brings the price up and makes you stay after those activities more. So they're kind of a distraction. There's something to be said about a simple airplane that's basically just sticker and rudder and maybe an airspeed indicator. But that's not what everybody wants. So depends on what you're looking for, I guess.
Yeah, you wrote in an article recently, I thought, said it well. You said, quote, "I maintain you've always been able to find affordable new airplanes, but you had to accept something other than 150-knot four-seater." End quote, which I think is a great way to say it. And you look at a lot of LSAs out there, they're marvelous airplanes, but the panel looks absolutely nothing like a 1946 Cub that maybe was the inspiration for it. So I think we've come an awfully long way from there. And that just reflects customer preferences. I don't think that's an evil scheme. I think that's what people ended up ordering. So I want to ask you about the LSA safety record. That's been part of the discussion with Mosaic and the idea of allowing higher weight airplanes that maybe would be a little sturdier, particularly in the flight training environment, which, as we all know, can be pretty tough on airplanes. How would you describe the safety record of LSAs overall, and what are your hopes for that under a new Mosaic regime?
We have been getting updates. That's one thing FAA does very well with the LSA community, I felt. I can't say how they do with all other communities because I'm involved with this one, but I feel like they've done quite well with annual briefings on safety, going into as much detail as they had. Now, those details suffer from two things. Number one, we don't have a real long track record in the number of years, only goes back 20 years. Number two, the volume of aircraft was growing but started small, so there's the sample size is relatively small. Therefore, all the numbers are somewhat less reliable than they are in other categories. But what FAA shows is that LSA fall between Part 23 type certified aircraft and experimental aircraft, much closer to the type certified aircraft. In other words, it's sort of a certified light, if you want to call it that, that makes it look like the lesser requirements of the aircraft make them somewhat less safe, than a fully conventionally certified aircraft. In fact, there may be other reasons for that. And again, I go back to the sample size and the length of the track record. I believe, however, that when FAA uses the following word, it's of just about the highest praise they will give it. And they say the LSA safety record is, quote, acceptable, end quote. You don't say that when it needs work. And I believe that they're you know, also unwilling to go out and say, oh, they have just been safe. They can't say that. There have been accidents. There have been loss of life, and all of those tragic. But fortunately, they've been relatively low, and the trends are good. So this industry has really done quite a job of not only creating standards that produced aircraft that could be operated by regular pilots without exceptional skills and yet have a good safety record, but also, you know, kept track of updates and safety requirements and the system that is produced to create what's called continued operating safety is very workable and has achieved those successes. That's why FAA wants to use this industry consensus model, which produced those aircraft in Part 23 type certified airplanes as time goes forward. They've been working on that for years. Pieces of it, I think, are not far off from getting implemented, and that's an exciting change for all of aviation. And by the way, that stuff goes global pretty easily, so it makes the entire world a marketplace for these producers.
When I think about the light end of general aviation, or affordable aviation, as you call it often, I think of sort of three legs of the stool. There's the LSA world that we've been talking about a lot. There's the kit-built route, which has been very hot over the last decade or so. You know, Vans leading the charge, but many others showing you can have very capable airplanes in a home-built format. The last leg I think of is ultralights, which you cover a little bit on your site, but I feel like often gets much less attention among quote-unquote regular pilots. Why do you think ultralights aren't more popular? They are an accessible and easy way to get into aviation.
They are, and they have the shortest and simplest regulation in all of aviation globally, which literally can be printed on the front and back of a single sheet of paper. Wow. That's the entire regulation. That's it, top to bottom. There was a time when I could read it to you off the top, just off the top of my head. I knew every single word in it by heart. And lots of pilots did, because it's only a page and a half. I mean, if rules are good, to me, they are few, simple, and memorable. And Part 103 fits that perfectly. But they're kind of the invisible segment, because people don't see them so much. So they assume there's not much happening. In fact, there's three or four producers that can't keep up with demand. One of them, very near me here, produces an airplane called the Aerolite 103. He restricts the number of them that he will sell, because he doesn't really want to keep growing his business to keep up with it. It's that there's that much going on. But these airplanes tend to fly in places away from airports, maybe out of a field somewhere. They can take off and land in 250-foot runways, no problem. Most of them, you know, assuming approaches and departures are not congested, but so these aircraft are very versatile in that sense. They're generally small and quiet. They hold one person, so you're not hauling people with you to some airport. You're just going out and getting your airplane flying. And a lot of times they can be folded up and put away, and you don't even see them. So they're this invisible segment of aviation that I contend sells about as many units per year as fully built LSA sell per year in the United States. And most people would go, you must be consuming something you shouldn't be consuming if you say that. And that's just because they aren't watching. I created a list on my website of Part 103 producers. There's like 60 models on there. These are active today. They're out there. They're all over the place. And there's some of them are some very nice little fixed wing airplanes. And they cost anywhere from, literally, I'm not kidding here, $15,000 to $35,000 is the price range of a Part 103. Ready to fly. So tell me, in the modern age, when an automobile is better than $40,000+ now, the average cost of an automobile, when you can buy an airplane for less than that, perhaps half of that. Now, again, it's not going to haul you and your favorite co-pilot along on a cross-country trip for several hundred miles, but it'll sure give you a lot of joy in the evening.
All right, Dan, at the end of every one of these episodes, we always close with our Ready to Copy segment. I'll ask some questions on a variety of topics, and you give me your quick answer. Are you ready to copy?
I'll do my best. Ready to copy.
We both just got back from Oshkosh recently. What was the most interesting new airplane you saw up there? You have a great way of getting around the show and seeing what's new. What impressed you?
Well, I'd have to put it in categories because I can't narrow it down to one. So I'll just give you the four that caught my attention right off the bat. One of them was a Sky Ranger, an airplane you can get in the air for less than $45,000. I think that's pretty cool. Another one was the Safari XL, which came from South Africa from a company called Kit Planes for Africa. They have a bush airplane that, well, Africa bush. You'd think that would have to be pretty durable. Looks like it is. Another one that just charmed me all to pieces was a home-built aircraft up in the Kit aircraft area called the Jenny from Timber Tiger Aircraft. And let's see, what was my fourth one of that week? Drawing a blank here right now. But down in the ultralight area, there were two or three models of Part 103 aircraft, the Hawk Ultra Air, the Nano Gyro, and the Composite FX helicopter. And all of these airplanes are Part 103, and they're, I think, just a striking amount of the choices that you can find there at Oshkosh. But by no means all. That leaves out so many, and I'm certainly doing a great disservice here.
How about in the LSA world? What's your favorite LSA you've ever flown in these over these past 20 years? I know you've flown in a lot.
You know what? That question just has to go to accomplish what? My real charge in life is soaring. I love to go soaring. So I guess if I had to narrow it down to one, it would have to be the one that was probably the best at soaring of that. And that was the Pipistrel Cenas with the long 50-foot wingspan on that. That'll stay up a long time. And it's a well-produced aircraft.
What's an underrated or overlooked LSA that's popular or great flying and not enough pilots know about?
Well, one that is, so this is an interesting one that I'm going to mention. It's actually a kit plane. It's not an LSA, but it's the AirCam. And it's one that can be, now get this, this is a multiple engine aircraft too. We didn't even talk about that. But multiple engine can be an MLSA. So that's interesting. To me, it's one of the most interesting aircraft I've ever flown because you can fly safely at 10 feet over the orange orchards down here in Florida, and you are not in a risky position. I wouldn't say that about, I'm not sure I can say that about any other aircraft I would say that about. So for me, that's a very special choice.
So glad you mentioned the AirCam. Absolutely one of my favorite airplanes of all time in the fun category. Just unbelievable. The closest thing I think you can get to actually flying like a bird, sitting out way in front of that wing and the engines behind you, wind in your hair. How would you describe that in a few words for a pilot who's never been in an air cam? What would you describe that experience like?
I'm gonna adapt what somebody else referred to about an ultralight called a drifter, which was similar. It was a single place aircraft, but you sat way forward in front of the wing. And that person said that it was a lawn chair on the edge of forever.
That is fantastic. I'll definitely use that one. A new airplane that got some attention starting at Sun and Fun and was at Oshkosh was the Junkers A-50, kind of a modern airplane, but with a very vintage look. Do you think airplanes like that, is that the start of a new trend, or is this just a one-off by an enthusiast owner?
Well, they're going to produce it, and wasn't it lovely? For those that saw it, I did some articles about it as well if you want to see it, but it was just a super handsome job. In fact, they poured so much into it. Now I suspect they're having to go through some efforts to try and lighten here and there and do the refinements that are necessary after you produce the first example. But it did fly and it looked good. No, it didn't look good. It looked fantastic. I mean, if you don't find that appealing, then I don't know what appeals to you. But it may not be the one you want to fly. But gosh, if you landed in that thing at an airport, everybody would walk over and have a look at it.
That is absolutely true. You're not going to be buying a lot of coffees at the local airport diners if you land in that. You mentioned before, Dan, that you work with the FAA a lot and you have for many years, many people. So I always like to ask this question of people who work with the FAA, not just complain about it. If we made you administrator for a day with sweeping powers, what is the top of your to-do list? What would you change?
Hasten and enhance their interdepartmental communication. huge thing to do. That's a giant organization. I don't know, 40,000, 50,000 employees, so much bigger than I can possibly imagine that I almost have no right to say anything about how they run the shop. But it's clear the left hand often doesn't know what the right hand is doing, or if they do, they don't like that the other one's doing it or stuff like that. Now, that's bound to happen, but and I don't know how you manage all that, but it seems to me that's a lot of what needs to happen. When we worked with the guys on Aircraft Cert, it was a wonderful experience, I'll have to say. I mean, we had our times when we clashed, of course, just like any groups might. But for the most part, it was very harmonious working together. The guys in the pilot, in the flight standards, where pilot certification happens and operating limitations happen, very nice and pleasant, but we just didn't get much out of them. They didn't have to give us stuff like these Aircraft Cert guys had to give ASTM, so they didn't. And so there's some of that that they like to keep things to themselves. So interagency communication and external communications, difficult thing to do well, but they could do better.
I know you've attended the Aero Friedrichshafen show in Germany, as I have. A very civilized show, I think, in many ways. Also a very fun show to get connected with European light aviation. What's one idea we Americans should steal for our air shows from that event?
Well, putting the whole thing inside is not such a bad idea. Sure is pleasant over there. My shoes don't get dirty. I love our outdoor air shows. Don't get me wrong, Sun and Fun and EAA and all the others. But gosh, it is civilized in that show. What's interesting there, I don't know that we should adopt this, but I noticed that it's a distinct difference in how cultures work. In Europe, governments give grants to groups. That was a lot of G's, much more so than they do here. And they also try to link universities with projects more than we do here. The latter, I think we could do more of. It's great training for university students, and it gets small companies. These companies that I work with are often 10, 20, 50 employees. That's it. And, you know, a handful of engineers. I mean, they can't think of and do everything themselves. So when they can link up with a university, which has very knowledgeable people and students that need experience, that seems a great idea. The money grant part, I'm a little less sure of because that's taxpayer money we're talking about. But what it does do is produce ideas on airplanes that will never go to market, but which can inspire active producers to go, huh, we could do that. And I think that's a great thing that they do well over.
It's a very good answer. I was going to say the beer garden. So you had a much more thoughtful response than I did. Thank you for that.
Well, now let's not go too far here. I enjoy that too. So,
Dan, our last question is always the same on pilot's discretion. You have one final flight, and we want to know, what are you flying and where are you going?
I'm going to take a sailplane and just ride that thermal as high as I can.
Dan, thanks for being on the podcast.
Great pleasure, John. Thanks for having me, and best to all the listeners.
Thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion, brought to you by Sporties, training and equipping pilots worldwide for over 60 years. For more episodes and today's show links, visit sporties.com/podcast. I'm John Zimmerman. We'll see you next time on Pilot's Discretion.